Radio MD. RadioMD.com.
He's a cardiologist. He's a chef. He's America's culinary interventionalist. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Michael Fenster.
Hello, Food Nation, Healthy Nation. Are you ready for the scrumptious and the salubrious part deux today? I know that you are. I know that you have been, you know, just drooling at the mouth for a week waiting for our conclusion. I've got Chef Luca here. This is Code Delicious with Dr. Mike. I am Dr. Mike. It's culinary CPR. It's part two of Chef. What are we doing?
Eggplant melanzane parmigiana con Dottore Mike e Luca.
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing in part two. So we're going to finish up giving you these tips. And as Chef pointed out, this is, you know, it can be a great dish any season using chicken, veal, you know, whatever you want. But a wonderful sort of end of summer into fall using the eggplant that you're going to find at the farmer's market that's in abundance this type of year. As he pointed out, zucchini, any of our kind of squashes here. We were focusing really on eggplant just because I think for folks that don't do a lot or don't have a favorite recipe, as you and I chatted about earlier, there's just such a diversity of opinion on how to do this. And I think to this point, you've really walked people through not only a great recipe that's going to set them up for success, but like most Italian cooking, Chef, it's beautifully simple.
Well, and that's the thing about you nailed that. Italian food is so simple. It's do this, do this, do this, get out of the way. And really is that, you know, that's why Italian grandmothers always made it look so easy and sometimes had to stretch out the amount of time they did things because they wanted to look like they were doing something more. But when you really nail it down to the brass tacks for these guys, it was few ingredients, make sure they're good, and get out of the way. And the eggplant parmesan, the building of a good eggplant parmesan is exactly that. But there are some techniques. So just to quickly recap, with thin sliced eggplant is important, good breadcrumbs, and using your breadcrumbs and mixing them well, but keeping it dry, making sure that you use a dry cheese, using fresh herbs in there, but chopping them up and adding them into a food processor and mixing them well. You have the egg wash, so we fried our, and we're, you know, frying eggplant a little at a time so we're not overcrowding and then making them soft and mushy. So you have these crisp eggplants. Your marinara sauce, your tomato sauce that you're going to use with this is totally up to you. You have a mother's favorite recipe, your own favorite recipe, but it's just really important to make sure it's a good, thicker sauce. Here's important, too. You don't want it too watery because you're not going to be using a lot. It's a layer to just moisten, you're not making a stew with the eggplant. You're just making it's a layer, like making a lasagna. You never want to make it too wet because you could always add sauce afterwards. And then a cheese as your finish. Now, we're going to talk a little bit today about fresh mozzarella, making your own and what have you. But it's important to bring in a drier version of that mozzarella than a really fresh because, again, you don't want too much moisture to a dish. I think that's important when we're building this eggplant parm. We want enough moisture so it solidifies and comes together. But if you add too much liquid, whether it's moisture from the cheese, the fresh mozzarella, or the sauce, and it's too watery, then it's all going to break apart and be a mess. So I think that's another key we have to focus on when we're making the perfect eggplant casserole, just like any other casserole. Can't be too wet. It has to hold together a little bit better. So for that end, if you make your own homemade mozzarella, which is not a hard process and on two levels, you can make it from scratch when you have the milk, and Michael will tell us a little bit about that, and you can make it from curd. It's good to then salt it and then keep it for a couple of days in the fridge so the moisture then comes out of it, and now you're using a drier version of it. But if you buy a mozzarella too, you know, a drier mozzarella works better, and then or mix in some parmigiano cheese into that mix so it dries it up just a little bit. Did I give out too much information?
No, because I want to know. That's great. And you know, people, we kind of throw around this term mozzarella, you know, with the cheese, and yet there's again a whole gamut of different forms, types, and processing that goes on with mozzarella. So the first thing I say is, you know, I stay away from sort of the bargain basement, industrially processed types of mozzarella that you see in the big bags. You know, that's not what you're going to find in a real Italian kitchen or your kitchen or certainly my kitchen. And again, it's got those processing types of additives, that manufacturing technique that we see now is negatively affecting the gut microbiome we have. And so this is where I think when we talk about kind of the fast food industry, this is what they're going to use on their, you know, Parmigiano sandwiches and their cheeses, and why we see some negative health effects associated with that kind of, you know, processed food consumption versus something very natural. And I want to even go back to the original mozzarella, because it's something that when I see it and I see it's come from Italy, you know, it's going into my shopping cart, and that's buffalo mozzarella. Yeah, so mozzarella, why don't you tell the folks what it is?
Yeah, mozzarella di bufala is the original mozzarella. Now, when you hear buffalo, don't think, you know, our first, your first vision in your head is, you know, the buffalo, the bison that roam the plains of the United States. It's not an American water buffalo in that term.
Do not try to milk those, folks.
I would stay away from that. They are water buffalo, but they're more of the ones that you kind of see in the herds, you know, in the African northern plains, that kind of look. But they were raised in southern Italy as one of their main means of milk and meat. Bufala, that's what they were called, and buffalo, and mozzarella was being made from that. Now, mozzarella is the, you separate the curds and the whey, and there's processes you could do at home, but, you know, in the big cheese factories or in the big plants where they do the separation, they go into these giant vats of swimming pool that look like swimming pools. You add rennet for it. It separates the whey. Whey floats to the top. Curd drops to the bottom. Then the curd is taken out and dried over time, or more moisture is taken out. And this is the building block of all cheese. Now, the mozzarella di bufala is an amazing variation of what we think of for mozzarella. First of all, the texture is a little creamier. Second of all, a little bit more acidic in flavor. I mean, it's just, if you put them side by side and you're used to buying string cheese out of a supermarket, that tells you it's mozzarella, which is this processed thing, and you add mozzarella di bufala, you wouldn't even think they're the same thing. It's not even close. And fresh mozzarella itself, it's got a different mouthfeel, and it tastes more milky, like what we're used to, than this buffalo mozzarella. But
you know, I would think, and you tell me, I think that one reason there had been such a craze for burrata is that it's more like buffalo mozzarella.
I totally agree. Every time I try it, I think the same thing. Yes. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've had burrata on my menu, and the first time I had a burrata, I went, wow, you know what this reminds me of? And they all went, what's that? I'm like, wait, we don't want to go there. Let's forget it. But it does. It's that texture, that kind of creaminess. It breaks apart on the inside. It doesn't have this, you know, because when you start drying out a regular homemade mozzarella or a fresh bought, store-bought one that's made there or made at a factory that's local or you know, a farm, those, once they start hardening or drying out, get this denseness to it. Yeah, buffalo mozzarella, the older it gets, the more it starts to even separate. You'll never really get a dense mozzarella. So that's used as a fresh mozzarella. I'm sure it can be done using it as a dry. But over time, what happened was the mozzarella gained so much popularity in Italy that everybody wanted it. And the further north you went, everybody had cows. They didn't have the buffalo. So they had to start making it from that milk, and then that's what really took over and became this populous mozzarella throughout the world. But we talk about high moisture content. Mozzarella di bufala has it, and that's why margherita pizzas, the original margherita, had that kind of mozzarella on it, and it was just pieces here and there, not like what we think of when we think of a cheese pizza now, where the cheese is everywhere. If you did that with this fresh mozzarella, you'd have just a big pile of water or liquid, and it'll never dry out to make a good pizza. So
I was going to say, you'd have this soggy bottom. You'd have the dreaded soggy bottom on your crust. Soggy.
You're getting that from that English baking show.
Oh! I love that. I love that show with they left. It was Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood.
Paul Hollywood.
I've got to tell you, Marty. I've got to tell you, Marty. You want to stay away from the soggy bottom.
You got that. Well, and it's amazing. You know, this could be a show. I wish my daughter would get on TV on radio. But she is the best baker I've ever met, and part of it, and she's only 14, part of it is because she fell in love with this show, and she tries to emulate everything they bake, which I'm so happy
awesome.
About, because I hate baking, and I love that she bakes, so.
Well, I'm like you. I'm not a, you know, and people often think, oh, well, you know, you're a chef, and you went and trained, so obviously, you know, but pastry chefs and I think serious bakers are a breed apart. And I'd even say between bakers and pastry chefs, there's a world of difference. I'm like you, you know, I enjoy making breads.
Right.
And I'm definitely, you know, not much of a baker. You know, I can do it in a pinch. But it's a different kind of art form for sure, I think.
Whole different world. And a different mentality and sensibility too. Like, I don't have the patience to weigh enough stuff out and measure no, this is fine. And you can't do it. You know, I don't have what it takes to bake.
Well, it's just different, right? You're not like tasting cake batter as you go along and go, oh, I need a little more of this and a little bit.
Yeah.
Cause you know, so you can't kind of do, and when it comes to baking, you know, it's a different mentality because it's not like you go down to the garden and say, oh, you know, I've got some fresh, lemon cucumbers and I've got some wonderful, Roma tomatoes that are coming in. I know what I'm doing for my appetizer tonight.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's like I'm making mangaroons or I'm doing a Victoria sponge. So anyway, when you see Bella tonight, you could tell her we were talking, you know, about Paul Hollywood and Mary in the soggy bottom.
That's a big thing at our house right now. Everything is just soggy bottoms. Soggy bottoms. Anyway, I don't know how we went from eggplant parmesan to this, but we got into mozzarella.
We did talk about that. You know, you got to crisp your eggplant because if you overcrowd the pan, you're going to have a soggy bottom.
No soggy bottoms on eggplants. That's important.
And as you said, if you use a really fresh mozzarella with the high water content and use too much of it, that water is going to, as you cook it, that water is going to come out and you're going to find your eggplant parma swimming in a tomato, sort of a tomato pool.
Right. So, and that's important when you're baking this off, is your moisture content is really important for what you're doing. So make sure you're not as high in moisture content. And when you've then baked it and done it in layers, so let's go back to building it all, right? So sauce on the bottom of the pan, your fried eggplant, sauce on the fried eggplant, but just enough. You know how like to, when you go to a pizzeria and you see they put just a little bit of sauce and then they push it around with the bottom of the ladle. You're doing the same thing. You're just making sure there's enough to coat every eggplant that's there, but not heavy. Then you put on your mozzarella and parmigiano layer. Then you repeat that till you get to the top, sauce, and then mozzarella on the top as well. And when you at three or four layers is pretty much, depending on how big your pan is, don't make it too deep. A regular pan is, what, about 2 or 3 inches high, and you don't want to go more than 2 inches because that's a nice size eggplant parm. The bigger you make it, the more you have to bake it. You cover it with the foil on top so you're not burning the cheese on top initially. I'd say half hour, 40 minutes at 300 degrees will cook it through. And what you'll do with that, now, once you've baked it, all right, let's say we're cooking it all through. Remember, most of this is already cooked. You're just melting the cheese into the eggplant and warming the sauce. The biggest, the most important, this technical key is what will make the difference between you serving a perfect eggplant parmesan and one that is going to be a mess. You do not serve it the day you make it. You let it cool. You refrigerate it overnight. And then the next day you pull it out and you cut yourself the slice size you want. It'll come out perfectly all together, especially if you didn't put too much sauce. Warm up a little sauce next to you. You want to heat this up back in the oven, you know, for 15, 20 minutes at 350 degrees. If you're in a hurry and you have to microwave it, go right ahead. It microwaves perfectly, but you have that little extra sauce. Pour it in a plate on the bottom, the eggplant parmesan on top of that, little parmigiano cheese, some fresh basil to garnish. You will have made the most perfect eggplant parm of your life if you follow these techniques. And it'll stay together and it'll look like it was meant to be in a restaurant.
And that's a important tip. And if it sounds like people are going, well, like, holy cow, I never heard about holding. Just think about like a chili or a cassoulet or something like that where, and I've got some now, you know, I did a talk about fresh Mediterranean cuisine. So we have this abundance of tomatoes and watermelons. So I did a watermelon gazpacho. Nice. But I'm letting it sit for 2 days before I eat it. So for the same reason you just said, so all those flavors can kind of come together. So I think that that's a step that most people overlook. They think they've got to serve it that same day that they cook it, when actually, wow, now you've not only given us a great recipe, chef, but you've given us something that we can do ahead and then serve in, you know, a day or two later in the week when we're busy that you're just reheating. So
well,
what
Italian
a great utilitarian recipe.
Was built around that. You know, lasagnas, eggplant parm, anything that's an Italian casserole was built around making it ahead so that way you could use it later on in the time frame. Whether it's lunch the next day or dinner 2 days later, or something you freeze and put away too and pull out at another time. I mean, that's what the casserole was made for, whether it was Italian casserole or what you think of for American casseroles too. And that technique is just historical but it comes out so much better. I've never had an eggplant parm the day after or 2 days after and not gone, wow, this thing has gotten better over time. It dries up a little bit. It sets, and that's important. That's just like, you know, we just mentioned talking about cakes. Yeah. Setting your cake is as important as baking it. You don't want to do anything when it's not set, because then you'll mess it up. It works the same way for an eggplant parmigiano, which is basically.
But the problem here, Mary, was that they didn't let their sponge set.
See? We're learning from that show.
I tell you what, I'll be completely honest. I learned a tremendous amount, and I was blown away by those amateur bakers, because they were baking things that I couldn't do. And some things, again, you know, it certainly increased my fund of knowledge, because there were sort of many of these English types of desserts and things that I had no idea. Right. And I was just over in the UK a couple of months ago in May and June. Doing some research for the new book, finishing up, and I actually got to try them, and I think I had more enjoyment because I knew more about it and more about the preparation. Right. And I think right now, you know, this is the same thing. We've spent sort of a lot of time, covered a lot of techniques that you can apply, but not just eggplant to chicken, veal, you know, whatever, you know, you want a Parmesan, but they're basic kitchen techniques. I think you really did a wonderful job explaining not just how to, but why to do certain things in terms of, you know, Italian cooking. And we know the Mediterranean approach is so powerful in terms of the happiness. I'm sure you would agree, you know, it delivers in terms of flavor, taste, and textures. But when you look at the health benefits, I mean, it just blows away what folks are eating in this country.
Right.
And now you can see why going to your restaurant and getting something prepared like this is very different than going to a chain, you know, Italian chain, where people are assembling food. So it's already coming processed in a box. And somebody's sticking it, you know, under a salamander or something to heat it up. It's not the same food.
Right.
You know,
you know, and there's a reason why the grandma's or nonna's lasagna and baked ziti and baked this and baked that was so good. It's because that kind of love can't be manufactured in mass. It has to be done. Yeah. With the love and the technique that you get at someone's home. So that's what we try to emulate, because that's the way I want to grow up.
Well, and that's real food. You know, real food is not just about some objects on a plate. It's something that we experience. And what you put and your attitude Somebody said something to me once, and I agreed with it. It's like, I never want to eat the food of an angry chef.
Yeah.
you know, it was actually my good friend, Anya McAteer. She cooks for celebrities. And I can't name drop, but I will give the name that she was willing to share when she was on the program. So she cooked for like Tom Cruise and, you know, that level, and Nicole Kidman. So that is what she does. And she's like, you know, one reason she attributed her success, you know, here's an Irish country girl, you know, cooking for Hollywood's elite. And she says, you know, I never, you know, I'm always in a good mood, and I meditate before I go in and make their food. So it comes out as food of love, and it's positive. And she said, you know, I never, ever want to go somewhere and have to eat the food of an angry chef. And I thought that was pretty powerful, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't either. And it's exactly what you're hitting at, chef, you know, the food reflects, I think, not only the ingredients, but the attitude and the mindset of whoever's making it. And don't you agree? I mean, I know that's a little
absolutely
esoteric. Mike.
I mean, I feel that when we talk about what we do, I always tell everybody that, you know, I'll stop doing this the day it becomes a job, because there's nothing worse than knowing that you're not putting a passion behind it. And I think that by the people who are listening to us today on the radio are getting the idea. They're listening because they want to cook more. They want to do something more exciting. They want to see what else they could do because they're still passionate about it. And the day you're not, it's not going to come out the same. Try to cook when you're in a bad mood. See what happens. And it's not as much fun. So it's really about, you know, putting, remember we talked about this all the time, Mike. It's put your love in your food, right? And if you have that passion, absolutely, that love, and goes into it, that's why my grandma's ravioli were always the best, because I would want them all the time, and she would love to make them for me. You go.
and you're really hitting, and it really is the emphasis of my new book, which hopefully we've just finished the manuscript, so hopefully we'll be out early 2018, probably springtime or so when we're done with edits.
Awesome.
But it's called Food Shaman, The Art of Quantum Food. And it really talks about, and it's amazing, as I did the research for it, because it was a concept I had, an idea I had that you and I have talked about and what we're talking about now, which is the power of this food experience. And it was fascinating to get into the research and find, particularly as a physician and someone who's, you know, grown up and operates by a lot of, you know, hard science edges, that there are these very powerful soft edges. And for example, you know, folks, you know, will often say grace or the equivalent, you know, take a moment of gratitude about their food and their meal. And lo and behold, there's actually, you know, measurable effects on the immune system, people eating the same meal prepared by the same person, but it affects our physiology differently.
Right.
Depending on our attitude about how we eat the food. So, you know, as I like to say, you know, yes, we are what we eat, but we also eat what we are. And it's not just about the objects of the food, these, you know, boxes of nutrition, which is so often how we're told we need to value our food. It's about how we eat as well. And
To recap, Mike, we started with making eggplant parmesan, and we're talking about soul eating, as opposed to just eating to satisfy a craving. There you go. And it really is. It's perfect. And eggplant parmesan is the perfect item when you do it correctly. Will satisfy everything you're talking about. And it's a great, great dish. And for those people, and we started this whole thing, you know, you said to me, you know, I don't like eggplant, that's soggy. And then we got into
soggy bottoms,
man. Yeah. but you know, we started with that, and we ended up with, you know, if you do it correctly, you're going to make a wonderful eggplant parmigiana, and it's something you could then take to doing a chicken parm or anything. Or, you know, if some people don't like eggplant, doing a zucchini parmigiana works out deliciously well. I love that as a substitute to, and especially around here when so many people have so many zucchini at certain times of the year. It's a great way to use them up. And am I wrong in thinking that zucchini has a little bit more nutrition than eggplant does? Or does eggplant even,
you know,
is it just the food that's just there, or does it give you anything?
No, it definitely, gives you some things there. And one of the things we have to, appreciate and we have to understand, and this is something I'll be talking about. If there are health and wellness folks out there, I think there's a few seats left at the Rockstars of Health Conference at the University of Montana at the end of September. I'm one of the keynote speakers, is that, and I'll be talking about this, touching on the subject. Even when there are things that don't directly affect us in terms of nutrition, they can have profound effects on our gut microbiome. So something like eggplant, which, for example, is rich in certain types of fiber, is really good for the gut bacteria. And so while you may say, well, for a human being, it's not, one of the top 10 nutrition-packed, nutrition-dense offerings out there. It provides a wonderful substrate for our symbiotic organ, which is the gut microbiome. And that is critical in how we develop in terms of health and wellness or disease and disability. And then the other thing that you and I touched on and we ended on with is, which is, what's our attitude? If you are really set and you really enjoy eggplant Parmigiano, well, gosh, when you eat happy and you're happy, that actually, believe it or not, also has an effect on the gut and gut microbiome. So it's a very complex, interplay of all these forces. And, we kind of joked about where we wound up, Chef, but I'll tell you, I think what we ended up on is really the essence of Mediterranean cuisine because it's about that approach.
Mike, what I'm ending up on is I'm going to go get myself a slice of eggplant parmigiana and enjoy that the rest of the day because now I'm starving.
Well, that makes two of us. So thank you, Chef. The culinary CPR segments with you are always one of my favorite. And what a great breadth of topic we did, Mediterranean approach, great example recipe. Folks, make sure you subscribe to the newsletter at chefdrmike.com so you can get Chef Luca's Parmesan recipe, which will be there. All these great tips that we gave you over the course of two programs here. And until we meet again, may the only pain in your life be champagne.